Welcome to When Things Go Wrong, a show about what to do when things you expect to go just fine simply don't. I'm your host, Frank Sipovitz, and in this episode, we're going to talk with someone who fully understood that things very likely would not go right even before his very first day on the job, and no matter how prepared he was or how well he performed. Our very special guest, Willie O'Ree, was the first player of African descent to play in the National Hockey League, and that was back in 1958. Like the vast majority of NHL players of the time, Willie was born and raised in Canada, Fredericton, New Brunswick, to be exact. He played two seasons in the NHL, followed by a long hockey career in the Western Hockey League, where he led the league in scoring twice, and also played in the American Hockey League before hanging up his skates at the age of 43 in 1973. Willie was honored with the Order of Canada in 2008, the highest civilian award for a Canadian citizen, and was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2018. His number 22 jersey was retired earlier this year by the Boston Bruins. And a marvelous film, appropriately titled Willie, a documentary about his journey, was released in 2020. That journey was not easy, and it was filled with things gone wrong and things that were just plain wrong. And how could it have been otherwise? The world was different when Willie O'Ree entered the NHL. Are things different for hockey players of color today? Well, whatever the differences are, it's in part because of the trailblazing efforts back then, and still today, of our guest Willie O'Ree. Welcome, Willie. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you made your NHL career with the Boston Bruins on January 18th, 1958, when you were signed to replace an injured player on the roster. So tell us what that night was like and what was going through your mind before taking the ice for the very first time at Boston Garden.
Well, I was in Quebec playing with the Quebec Aces in the Quebec Professional League. I got the call from the Bruins to meet the Bruins in Montreal to play two games against the Montreal Canadiens. When I arrived in Montreal, I was met by Coach Milt Schmidt and General Manager Lynn Patrick. They sat me down and said, Willie, we brought you up because we think you could add a little something. Don't worry about anything else, about just going out and playing your game. So basically, that's what I did. I had played against the Montreal Canadiens in exhibition games, but this was going to be the first NHL game. And, I had prepared myself to a certain extent, and I had the butterflies until I stepped on the ice. And then when I stepped on the ice that first shift, everything seemed to settle down, and we were fortunate to beat Canadians that night. We shut them out 3-0. It was a Saturday night, and shutting out the Montreal Canadiens in the Montreal Forum on a Saturday night was just a feat in itself.
So this was a remarkable personal accomplishment, of course, getting to the NHL, because any player who's played junior hockey, semi-pro hockey, that's their goal, right? That's where they want to get to. But did you fully appreciate the significance of what that achievement meant as a cultural milestone, but beyond the personal achievement?
Well, yes. When I was playing junior, I was told by my first junior coach, Phil Watson, when I was playing in Quebec, and he said, well, he says, there hasn't been a black hockey player in the National Hockey League. And he says, you have the skills and the ability to play. And, kind of went in one ear and out the other. But at that time, I just wanted to be a good junior player and represent the hockey club. My second year when I played in Kitchener, Ontario, Black Jack Stewart was the coach and told me the same thing. He said, Willie, there hasn't been a black player in the National Hockey League. And he says, you have the skills and the abilities. And then it kind of sank in a little bit with me, and I said, geez, maybe there's something to it. And then when I turned pro in 1956 with the Quebec Aces, and Punch Emlak was the coach and general manager, he told me the same thing. So I put those three things together, and I said, well, I said, there is possibly a chance that you could be the first. And, I didn't dream. I just went out and started playing. And then, when the Bruins called me up and I went to Montreal, it just seemed to all fall into place.
So you were thinking NHL right from the beginning.
I was thinking to get into the NHL. Yeah, I was saying, when they tell you, that you have the skills and the ability, and I always applied myself, to be the best hockey player I could be anytime I got on the ice.
So let's talk about that, because you did have the skill and the ability. So did others. There were other players of color in the hockey world on various levels, on professional and semi-professional sport during the first 50 years of the 20th century, like Herb Carnegie, for example.
Right.
Right. And Herb actually played on the Black Aces line with his brother Ozzie and Manny McIntyre in 1941,
yeah.
Right? And again in 1945. So how did their experiences inspire you?
Well, I had met Herbie and Ozzie Carnegie. I'd been in Herbie's home in Toronto. Manny McIntyre's from my hometown. But I said there's three black hockey players that played together, and I knew Herbie just by his experience that he could have been in the National Hockey League before me. He had the skills and the ability to be there. But unfortunately, there were circumstances that didn't permit him to play. But I really thought, and I kept it in my mind that just work hard and stay focused on what you want to do, and we'll just see what just see what happens.
Now, you've been referred to as the Jackie Robinson of hockey because, of course, you were the first. Mr. Robinson, of course, broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, and that's with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you actually met Jackie Robinson, is that right?
I met him on two occasions, yes.
Yeah, tell us about that experience and how he inspired you or informed you as an athlete.
Yeah. Well, I was playing baseball in my hometown, Fredericton, and I played shortstop and second base, and the team that I was on won the championship that year. The reward was that our team was going to be taken to New York to see the Empire State Building and the Radio Music City Hall and Statue of Liberty and all the tourist attractions. I met Mr. Robinson after a game at Ebbets Field, had the opportunity to go down and talk with him at the dugout. And I said, Mr. Robinson, I said, it certainly is an honor and a pleasure to meet you. And I says, I not only play baseball, but I also play hockey. And Mr. Robinson said, well, he says, I didn't realize that there were any black kids playing hockey. And I said, yes, Mr. Robinson, there's a few. And I talked with him for probably another 5 or 6 minutes. And he says, well, whatever sport you choose, he says, just work hard. He says, there's no substitute for hard work. He says, you only get out of a thing what you put into it. And so that kind of stuck with me. And then in 1962, the NAACP had a luncheon for Mr. Robinson at one of the local hotels in North Hollywood. I received an invitation through the hockey club. So we arrived at the hotel. Mr. Robinson was standing over in the corner talking to some media people, and the coach and three players were standing offside waiting for Mr. Robinson to finish. When he finished, the coach came over and said, Mr. Robinson, I'd like to introduce you to three of the local hockey players, especially Willie O'Ree, newly acquired from the Hell Ottawa Canadiens. And soon he said to Willie O'Ree, Mr. Robinson turned to me and looked at me right in the eye. And he said, Willie O'Ree, he says, aren't you the young fellow I met in Brooklyn? Now, this is 1949 when I met him for the first time, and this is 1962. So I must have had an impact on him when he met me, and he definitely had an impact on me meeting him for the second time.
Oh, Willie, you have an impact on everybody, I have to tell you. So you played in the NHL in the original six era. And for those of our listeners who don't know what that means, there were two teams in Canada, in right. Montreal and Toronto. There were four teams in the United States, which were Boston, New York Rangers, Detroit, and Chicago. Now, when you were on the road, did you get the same level of support that you did when you were in Boston playing for the Bruins, or were there other things going on in the background there?
Well, there were other things going on, but I had the support of the Bruin organization, especially the players that I was playing with, I felt confident. I knew that I'd probably be exposed to, some racial remarks and racial slurs, but it didn't bother me. When I went on the ice, all I wanted to do was concentrate on playing, to the best of my ability and representing the hockey club, you know, to the best of my ability. But I heard the racial remarks and the racial slurs, but I let it went in one ear and out the other. It really didn't affect my play.
Now, you were able to do that because you had the support of your team, and that was critical. If you didn't have that, it might not have been able to go out the other ear.
Oh, that's true.
Right? I mean, you were surrounded by people who were incredibly supportive of you personally.
Well, I fought a lot when I first started playing. I fought because I had to, not because I wanted to. I wasn't a big guy, you know. But, the only time I fought was when guys speared me and butted me and, you know, cross-checked me. And, you know, back then, none of the players wore any helmets or no face shields or cages. And I always tried to protect my face because, you know, I only had one eye. And, but I dropped my gloves and I won fights and lost fights. But
I mean, that's everyday hockey, even today. Maybe it was a little bit more prevalent back then.
Yeah. I think they kind of geared on me because of my color, but I always tried to represent the hockey club and went out and played to the best of my ability.
And your teammates came to your aid on the ice as well, I would imagine.
I can remember the one incident, and it's stuck in my mind over the years still. It was in Chicago. We were playing against the Chicago Blackhawks, and before the game, we're warming up, and one of the Chicago players came as we're warming up, and I'm skating around. He came by and took his stick and gave me a two-hander right across the ankles, and then he made a couple of racial remarks, and you know, he's shaking his head, and you know, so the game, the warm-up ends, we go in, the game starts. It's the second. I'm on the second shift on the ice. I got the puck, and I'm in behind the Chicago net. And I dumped the puck out to my winger. And this player came from my blind side. I couldn't see him. He came from my blind side, and he butt-ended me in the mouth and split my nose, knocked my two front teeth out. And I was bleeding, and I knew I was going to fight. So I dropped my stick and get into an altercation. We both were flown out of the game. The both benches emptied. All the Bruins come out of their bench. All the Chicago Blackhawks come out of there. It was 92 minutes in penalties assessed to the different players. And I'm in the dressing room, and after they stitched me up and plugged my nose, I was trying to listen to the game. And after the game, the fans became so violent that usually when you come out of the dressing room, the Chicago dressing, you walk up a ramp, up some stairs, and you'd walk out, and there'd be the bus. Well, I had to bring the bus all the way into the stadium and just park it outside the dressing room door. And then they threw a canopy over the dressing room door because there was fans down there throwing cans. And, you know, so we finally exited the building. And, that was my first time that I really had an altercation, since I had come up with the Bruins.
So remarkably, Willie, after your last game for the Bruins in 1961,
yes,
it took another 13 years before Mike Marson was drafted by the Washington Capitals in 1974, the next player of African descent. In your opinion, why did it take so incredibly long for another player of African descent to break in?
I don't know if they were ready, for another black hockey player, or maybe they were looking for a superstar, to come into the league. I played with a teammate, Stan Maxwell, hailed from Truro, Nova Scotia. Good hockey player. He was my center, and I played with him for 8 years. Could have played in the NHL, at that time. Herb Carnegie, again, and could have been there. But I don't know if it was the prejudice part or I knew that there were other players that were good enough to come up and play at that time.
Well, it's a shame that it did take so long.
That's true, it did.
Now, 2 years before your rookie season in Boston,
right,
you were injured by a flying puck that left you blind in one eye.
My right eye.
Yeah, it was the right eye. Yeah. So and it was against NHL rules for a player not to have use of both eyes. So how did you make the roster?
Well, I was playing junior. I was playing in Kitchener, Ontario, it was a, as I said, no face shields, no cages, nothing to protect your face. There was a slap shot from the point. One of my own defensemen slapped the puck. Kent Douglas slapped the puck. This defenseman come out to block the shot. The ricocheted, puck ricocheted off the stick. I'm in front of the net for a deflection. The puck come up and hits me flat, breaks my nose, cuts me around the eye. And I remember dropping down to the ice, and I could feel the blood rushing down. The next thing I knew was placed in an ambulance and taken to the hospital. Dr. Henderson was the doctor, the surgeon that operated on me. And I'd been in my recovery room, and Dr. Henderson came in and stood by my bedside, and he said, "Mr. O'Ree," he says, I'm sorry to inform you. He says, "The impact of the puck completely shattered the retina in your right eye." And he says, "You're going to be blind and you'll never play hockey again." Well, I was 19. And the goals and dreams that I set for myself seemingly were gone. So I remained in the hospital for another 3 or 4 days, and I get out. And within 5 weeks, I'm back on the ice practicing. Now, being a left-hand shot and playing left wing to compensate, I had to turn my head all the way around to the right to pick the puck over my right shoulder. And I was overskating the puck and missing the net. And I said, "Willie, what's wrong?" So I just said, "Forget about what you can't see and just concentrate on what you can see." So the season ends, and I come back to my hometown, and my parents were very happy that I was home, and that my eye injury was good, that I could see again. But I couldn't see. I was blind, but I didn't tell my parents. The only person I told was my younger sister, Betty. And I said, "Sis," I said, "don't say anything to anybody, because if they find out that I can't see, I will have no opportunity or chance to play, not only professional, but play in the NHL. So we kept that a secret. And Punch Emlek got a hold of me and said, "Willie, I'd like to invite you to the Quebec Aces training camp up in Quebec." So I went and played left wing. Didn't take an eye exam. That's the thing that I was worried about, that I was going to sit in front of an eye machine, because they'd have found out. No eye machine, so I played. I make the team and played. The Bruins invited me to their training camp in 1957. I went to the Bruins training camp. No eye machine, played there, went back to Quebec. 1958, went to the Bruins training camp again. No eye machine, went back. And then the Bruins called me up on January the 18th, 1958. And I just went out and played and didn't tell anybody. And I played 21 years, with one eye.
And in all that time, nobody knew?
Nobody knew, no. I didn't tell I didn't tell my teammates. I just told my older sister. That's the only person I told.
So how did you change your game in order to make it not apparent that you had a blind side?
When I was traded to the Los Angeles Blades in 1961, I went and I was playing left wing again. And then in 1965, I was still in Los Angeles. Alfie Pike was the coach, and we went to training camp, and I'm a left winger. He had about seven left wingers, and he only had two right wingers in training camp. So he said, "Willie, have you ever played right wing?" And I said, "No." I says, "I've always played left wing and left-hand shot." He says, "Well, I'd like you to try it." He said, "I'd like to use your speed over on the right side." So now I switch over to the right wing, and skating down the ice, the boards are to my right, and I can be looking to see everything coming out on my left side. So I played there that season, and I won the goal scoring. Only due to the fact that I had switched over and I didn't have to be turning my head, to pick the puck up.
So those were the years that you won the scoring title.
Yeah, 65 in Los Angeles and 69 in San Diego.
Yeah, because you changed sides.
Changed sides.
And it wasn't your decision. No. That was just, so you had all the angels on your shoulder, Willie, all the way through.
Yeah, really.
That's tremendous.
It took a few games to settle in, taking 90% of your passes on your backhand. But then you had the advantage when you're going down the ice, and then you're going in on the net, you have the advantage. And as I said, I scored 38 goals that year.
That's tremendous. So the poster for Willie, the award-winning documentary about your life, shows a subtitle that reads, How the Descendant of Escaped Slaves Changed Hockey Forever. And without question, Willie, you changed the sport of hockey and you're still changing it. We'll get into that in a minute, but how did hockey change you? What did it teach you about persevering and overcoming those challenges?
Well, I had always set goals for myself, and I still believe in setting goals for yourselves and working hard and, you know, believing in yourself. And, you know, hockey changed me because, you know, when I played, as I wanted to be the best hockey player I could be, I knew within myself the type of hockey player I was. And I always worked 100% when I went to training camp and the games. I just decided that that hockey gave me the opportunity to play the sport that I really wanted to play and excel in it. And I just told myself, work hard, believe in yourself, and don't let anybody tell you you can't attain your goal. If you feel strongly within your heart and within your mind, those are the two things.
And so the reason you knew where to aim is you knew where the target was.
Yeah.
You knew what you wanted, and you didn't let anything get in your way.
I didn't let anything
reach that
or anybody.
Goal.
And, you know, and I still live that way. You know, even today, you know, I still set goals for myself and work hard. And as I mentioned, there's no substitute for hard work. And I tell these boys and girls when I have the opportunity to talk to them, you know, it's how you feel within yourself. You know, if you feel good, if you think you can, you can. If you think you can't, you're right. And there's a lot of truth to it.
So it's that incredible focus that has made you so incredibly successful. You played professional hockey over two decades and into your 40s. And in the 1990s, you were an employee of the Hotel Del Coronado in San Diego.
I was a security guard.
Yeah, you were. And you were contacted and visited by an executive from the NHL who years later would actually be the producer of Willie.
Brian McBride.
Tell us about your meeting with Brian McBride.
How Brian contacted me. Brian was in New York at a meeting with, I believe, five or six other gentlemen. And one of them was Lou Vero, who was that time with USA Hockey.
Yep, Lou Vero. Yep.
Yes, Lou Vero. Great friend of mine. I love him. And so anyway, they were talking about how the NHL and how the USA Hockey could combine and open hockey up to every boy and girl that wants to play. Any boy or girl who wants to play. And Jackie Robinson's name came up. And they said, yeah, Robinson broke the color barrier in 1947 with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And then said, yeah. So then, just out of the blue, Lou Vero says, well, we have our own Jackie Robinson in hockey. And the room went silent. They said, well, who is it? Lou Vero said, Willie O'Ree. He says, I was living in New York and I watched him play in the old Madison Square Gardens. So then Brian McBride says, well, is he still alive? Is he still in San Diego? And Lou says, I think so. He was playing with the San Diego Gulls there in the Western Hockey League. So then Brian said, well, I'd like to get a hold of him. Maybe he'd like to get involved with this Hockey's diversity program at that time, which is now Hockey's for Everyone. So Brian called the San Diego Gulls and they wouldn't give my number. And he says, I'll leave a message. I'm Brian McBride with the National Hockey League. Could you please have Mr. Ree call me? So anyway, he couldn't get a hold of me. So he knew a couple of FBI gentlemen in San Diego. And he called them and he said, I'd like to see if you could get in touch with Willie O'Ree. I know he's working at the in San Diego, and I'd like to talk to him. So within a few hours, they called him back and said, called Brian back and said, yes, Mr. O'Ree is working over at the Hotel Del in the security department. So then Brian called me and he said, yeah, I'm Brian McBride. And I was a little hesitant at first. I says, well, why are you calling me? He says, well, I'm a newly appointed vice president of the diversity program with the National Hockey League. And he says, we have this program and I'd like to know if you would be interested in maybe working with the program. So, you know, he kind of laid it out. And I said, yes, it seems something that I'd be interested in working with kids. So anyway, that's how it all started. And I was going around and, you know, visiting schools and boys and girls clubs and juvenile detention facilities and the YMYWCAs, trying to encourage more boys and girls to get into hockey. And that's how it all started. And then, you know, he approached me about doing this documentary. I said, well, I don't know. He says, I've never been involved in other documentaries. He says, yeah. I says, I think it would be good. So he knew some influential people, and they started talking, and they got it all together, and then that's how the documentary came, well, you know, came about.
Well, it's a tremendous documentary, and for those of you who are listening, if you have the chance to stream it, by all means, you really should. It's a tremendous film. So, of course, you were the first player of African heritage that played in the NHL. We've talked about that during this entire episode, but that was not the end of the story. This season, there were 43 players of color on NHL rosters, and that's still not the destination.
No.
It's just a stop on the journey. Now, Willie, you continue to fight for inclusion and opportunity in the sport. Tell us about how you're transforming and through your early years working with the NHL front office, how you transformed the challenges and adversities that you experienced positive change in the sport.
I knew that there were other, not only black players, but players of color out there that, you know, that were playing hockey, young kids, you know, kids that were playing in junior and college. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to just make sure that hopefully that they get the opportunity to play the sport and have the opportunity to either get involved in organized hockey and you know, play. You know, when I first met some of the black players and players of color that are at that time were playing in the National Hockey League, I bring Jerome Iginla.
Calgary Flames.
Yes. I was invited to his training camp in school for kids in Calgary. You know, when I went there, and the first thing Jerome said to me, he said, Willie, he says, I can't imagine what you had to go through to make it possible for players like myself to play in the NHL. The perseverance and your attitude and everything that gave you not only the strength to play, but to carry on, you know, after the game. And then I met some other players that told me the same thing. And you know, it's when you hear that from players that are playing in the NHL that are, you know, making millions and thinking that of me and have that feeling to tell me about how I changed the game and made it possible for them. It was just a nice feeling.
Well, and I remember there was also a Willie O'Ree All-Star game.
Yes.
That the NHL, now I know that you're an incredibly modest individual, Willie, but tell us about the Willie O'Ree All-Star game, because I remember those really well.
Well, the first one was in Boston, and
who were the players? Tell us about who it was gauged toward, who it was positioned toward.
Well, the players that came to the Willie O'Ree All-Star, they were players that were picked from their programs. They were flown into Boston, put them up. We treated them like NHL players, and they wore NHL jerseys. They had NHL hats. They played two or three games, and it was just a fun weekend. We went to watch the Bruins play. Had autographs, pictures taken. It was just a fun weekend for these kids. I mean, some of them had never been out of their province. Some of them had never been out of their state before, and It was just a wonderful weekend, and I just had a great time being there with the kids and having pictures taken and autographs.
It must have been incredible for those players to meet other players from underrepresented and underserved communities.
Oh, they did, you know, to meet players from, you know, from other programs, and it was just a fun weekend. And then, you know, some of the Bruins came down and they had pictures taken with them and autographs. And I mean, it was a weekend these kids will never forget.
So players from these communities, underrepresented, underserved, in some cases, economically disadvantaged communities.
A lot of them.
What is your advice to them, drawing from your own experiences, if they wanted to make a name for themselves in professional hockey?
Well, the first thing I would tell them is believe in yourself. Feel good about yourself, like yourself. If you feel good about yourself and like yourself, other people are going to like you. But if you have a negative attitude, you know, towards yourself, I don't think people would like to be in your presence or be surrounded by you. The next thing I tell them is, you know, set goals for yourselves and work towards your goals. Goal setting is very important. And don't let anybody tell you you can't attain your goal. If you feel within your heart, within your mind, work hard and stay focused on what you want to do. And I mean, then it's up to you. It's entirely up to you what you want to do. But I stress this, you know, I've held a lot of clinics, you know, over the years, different cities. And I still tell these boys and girls, you know, work hard, stay focused, you know, feel good about yourself. And don't ever be ashamed of who you are.
And that's how you keep the noise out from anything else and everyone else on the outside, whatever they're saying or whatever they're alluding to, right?
It's true.
Well, friends, we've been talking with Willie O'Ree, an incredible story of how the great-great-grandson of an escaped slave from South Carolina went on to play 22 years in professional hockey. And since then, Willie O'Ree has traveled thousands of miles across North America to build and support 26 grassroots hockey programs, serving underrepresented, marginalized, and economically disadvantaged kids.
It certainly has been a pleasure. And, I have to thank Rob Woolley, my good friend with the National Hockey League, the work that we've done over the years. I'm just happy. And as I mentioned earlier, I've been blessed over the years. And thanks to my higher power that I can always turn to from time to time. And, you know, as I said, it's just nice being able to give back.
Well, Willie, it's a blessing to know you too, and to have worked with you back in my days at the NHL. And so, Willie, thank you. And listeners, thank you for joining us on When Things Go Wrong.
Thank you, everybody. A pleasure. Keep safe. Be well.
Learn more about how to plan for and survive the inevitable blips, bloopers, and blunders of life and business in What to Do When Things Go Wrong. Available in hard copy, ebook, and audiobook from Amazon.com and other fine booksellers. I'm Frank Sipovitz, and remember, if it hasn't happened to you, it just hasn't happened to you yet. The When Things Go Wrong podcast is produced by Chris and Mandy Wimmer and is a production of Black Barrel Media in association with Fast Traffic Entertainment. You can find more Black Barrel Media shows on Apple Podcasts or wherever you are listening. For more background on this show, join us at Black Barrel Media on Facebook and Instagram, at B Barrel Media on Twitter, and on our website at blackbarrelmedia.com. See you next time, if all goes well.